Hello, and here we are for the Tour de France podcast with humansinvent.com. My name is Richard Moore, and tonight I am with, as ever, Lionel Burney.
Evening, Richard.
With Matt Bowden of Velo News.
Why, hello there.
And making a late but very welcome appearance, one of the doyens of the press room, Andy Hood, also from Velo News.
It's such a steam company, I'm very happy to be here.
It's great to have you. Lionel, can you tell us where we are tonight? Not tell us, tell everybody else where we are tonight.
We are sitting outside the press marquee, a couple of kilometres from the summit of Semnoz. We're sitting on a wall next to an electric fence.
Well, it's not electric, actually, it's rope. I know that because I
the
just
the rumour's gone round the press room that it's an electric fence.
Maybe I'm immune to electricity.
Sticking with that.
So you heard there some of the sounds of the tour. That was some British fans this morning chanting "Froome, Froome" outside the Team Sky bus, and there was some crowd noises there, I think, also from the climb, because we were in the fortunate position, just 2 kilometres from the summit, of being able to actually go out and watch the race. It's not often that we're able to do that. We can sometimes see the finish, but not the actual race. And I think did we all go out? I certainly went out. Lionel, you went out. And Matt, you went out and watched the race. What were your impressions from the roadside?
You just said we don't get to watch the race very much. You know, you come and cover the bike race, and I hate to tell this to everybody at home, but sometimes we know the least about the bike race while it's actually happening. So we're forced to kind of piece it together. But we're just like 800 meters away from the corner here. So we went over there, Andrew Hood and Ted Cayley Fretz and myself, and we saw Quintana come through, which was great because, you know, I was on the front, and I was thinking we'd see Froome come through all alone at that point, but to see that he'd been brought back, because when I left the press room, he was attacking. And it was so wonderful to go out there and see the expressions on these guys' faces and sort of contextualize how fast they're actually going, because it's quite another thing to see it on TV than it is to see it in person and to sort of be a part of it.
And feel that, you know, the atmosphere, the crowd, that excitement that they feel having stood there for hours, you know, in some cases. Andy, how many tours have you covered now?
This is nearing the end of my 18th.
18th. So you're 2 away from your first, your special medal. But you must have watched it many times. Do you still feel that thrill of watching it?
Yeah, the tour is something that never really ceases to surprise. I mean, every year, I was thinking about that a couple of times during this tour, that every tour seems to have some amazing stories that comes out of it, out of the tour. It's never becomes a routine. You never know what's going to happen. In this tour, I think what's actually has made it interesting for me to stick around the sports salon is to see how the sport's changed and how it's evolved from this kind of scandal-laden, drug-plagued sport to what we hope and believe is a much cleaner place. And that's been really, I think, an interesting story and journey over the last 5, 6, 7 years. And it's been interesting on this tour, especially how those ghosts of the tour's past have been haunting this kind of Froome story.
The Froome story. We're going to get onto Froome in a minute, but marching towards us there, fresh from the press room, by popular request. And this isn't easy for him because he doesn't like the mountains. He's more a man of the beach. But we have Ciro from Gazzetta dello Sport. Ciro.
Hi to all our listeners. But guys, I should ask a question to you, first of all. Why are you laughing while I was arriving here?
Why were we laughing as you were arriving here, Ciro?
Just because
we anticipated that you were about to bring some levity and humour into our podcast, as you always do so masterfully. We're about to talk about Chris Froome. We've just had his press conference. He's going to win the tour. Ciro, can you give us some thoughts on Chris Froome? Your thoughts on Chris Froome. What do you make of him as a person?
Certainly, I don't know him very well personally. I had the opportunity at the beginning of December of last year to have an interview with him in South Africa, near Johannesburg, during the presentation of the MTN Kubeka. I had a meeting with him. I mean, he seems really polite, really different from I heard in the press conference that also there was a paragon with the cannibal, with Ed Merckx, but it looks so different as a character. Mm. I found very interesting, and also interesting maybe for our listener, the question about Bradley Wiggins, if I understand well, they didn't speak in this tour any longer with messages or by phone. And so, unfortunately, I didn't have the time to do this question to Chris. The question would have been, but Chris, maybe the most difficult moment for him in this tour was the Alpe d'Huez, when he had the crisis for sugar and Richie Porte gave him some sugar. So my question of the Chris, in your opinion, if Bradley Wiggins was in the place of Richie Porte, would that give you this sugar? It's one of the mystery.
Would he have given him the gel? That's
the
a
gel,
very
exactly.
That's a very good question.
One of the mystery of this tour.
Or would he have held it out in front of him and then thrown it onto the road?
Or would Froome have given gel to Wiggo?
I think it goes both ways, doesn't it? I think that antipathy is mutual. I was struck by one thing that he said during his press conference, where he was asked about where he felt that he was from, where was home, whether it's Kenya, where he was born, South Africa, where he was raised, where he has a house now, Monaco, where he lives, or Great Britain, where he represents. And he said, "I really do feel divided among those places. When I return to any of these places, it feels like home in a way. One thing that really does make me smile is when I go back to Kenya. Even going through customs control, they grin with their big smiles. That always makes me really happy." I think he's... One of his problems, I think, in expressing himself and even sort of tapping into some of those stories that he must have about growing up in Kenya, I think he's in a very difficult position where he really does feel that Kenya is home, but he's representing Great Britain, and he's kind of torn. I think that he feels that if he waxes lyrical about Kenya, it could backfire on him with the British public, and likewise, if he embraces Britain as much as, you know, he might feel he should, then it could alienate the people that he grew up with. I think that might explain some of his difficulties in communicating his personality. I don't know what you think, Lionel.
Well, when that question was asked, I had a quick look across at Chris Haynes, who is Sky's PR man, just to see what the expression on his face was as this question was asked and answered, and it was basically, you know, emotionless. But you do get the feeling that I don't think Chris Froome is pretending to be British at all, but I do think this is the first time we've heard him say that he has roots in now four different places. I don't think there's anything wrong with that. Oh, you know?
There's nothing wrong with that at all. I mean, I found that very endearing when he talked about going through customs and this. And to me, that was him. That was his heart speaking. That's where his heart is Kenya, Matt.
Don't you feel like that sort of sums up our problem in conveying who Chris Froome really is? Because he's not sure necessarily who he represents, and you know, in the various media scrums, he always comes across as very, very polite. And Andy Hood's actually working on a print piece about this right now. But it's that we essentially can't really describe Chris Froome because, you know, on the road he's this vicious cyclist,
killer,
you know, a brilliant rider, GC rider of reference at this point. But then, you know, in the press, it's all very different. He's very polite. I mean, I don't know of anybody who could have handled the amount of questions inquiring about his performance here and if it were legit with any more grace than Chris Froome. And I guess that's a testament to maybe his mild manner, and maybe we're grasping at straws here, because sports journalism is about developing characters as much as it is performance. But, you know, I think that Chris Froome wins next year's tour and the tour after that, we may still not know.
Yeah, I mean, Bradley Wiggins was a gift last year. There were so many rough edges to him, and yeah, a quotes machine. You would come out of a press conference with 100 stories. With Chris Froome, sometimes you're struggling for one. Andy, how's your story coming along?
Yeah, I think I find that sometimes as journalists we get too wrapped up in what they say to us. So I think to really tell a story of who a person is, you have to talk to people who know him. Mm. So that's what I've been trying to do, you know, during this tour. I mean, we've all sat down and talked to Chris, and he is just what he appears to be, a polite English schoolboy, doesn't matter where he was raised, that's what he is. And it's been interesting trying to talk to people who do know him to find out some of these anecdotes, to find out what his character is. And to be honest, even then, it's difficult to really kind of get a feeling of if he's not more than that, in the sense of that he is just a genuinely nice guy. And they say that he does kind of transform himself when he does get on the bike, which is interesting. It's telling about his character, I think, that he can vent or become something else that he perhaps isn't in everyday life, that he can become on the bike.
Well, I just always think back to 2009 when Chris Froome was leaving Barlow World to join the new Team Sky, and we took him out to London after the final stage of the Tour of Britain. And we kind of did a magazine feature in which we sort of took him around the sights of London, and we gave him a pint of English beer, and we made him eat a full English breakfast, sausage, bacon, tomatoes,
that
kind of thing.
He's been working that off ever since.
He has, yeah. And I just got to see a little bit of his character there, and again, you know, just very friendly, polite. One of the few, it's not often when you spend time with professional sports people that they ask you anything about yourself. And Chris was really interested in, you know, who we were and how long we'd been covering the sport, and what we thought about Team Sky and, you know, British cycling and all of that. And that left more of an impression on me at the time than really gleaning too much about him, other than this kind of the headline stories about being chased by a hippo or riding his bike on the freeway or motorway in Johannesburg and getting pulled over by the police, which are great lines, but they don't necessarily give you a tremendous insight into his personality.
No, I mean, he has obviously some very interesting experiences. He can also bring a fly back to life, as legend has it, using salt, and he's performed this party trick on a number of occasions. I spoke to Tim Harris about him this morning, actually. Tim Harris, who was on the podcast last week, is a former British rider who is driving on the race, and he put up Froome in his house in Belgium for a season back in 2007. And, you know, his first race he rode, which he referenced there, the first day he fell off his bike three times. He fell off three times in the first stage. And again, Tim talked about how polite he was, how well-mannered he was, and he said he was like a colonial gentleman. The only other athlete I can think of, actually, elite world, you know, world-class athlete, who's as polite as and as nice and as inquiring of others as him is Chris Hoy, Sir Chris Hoy. Arise, Sir Chris Froome? Maybe not. But anyway, I spoke to Geraint Thomas briefly this morning. Firstly, just quickly about his own health. He's been riding with a broken bone in his pelvis since the first day, and we'll obviously finish the tour now. And then we went on to talk a little bit about Chris Froome and his early impressions of him.
Feels a lot better, yeah. It's just more thinking about the legs now, which I saw, so I guess that's a good thing. And I can get out the saddle, and so yeah, it's all good. I can't, you know, I wouldn't be able to sprint for a win, but, you know, I can get out the saddle nicely.
Are you going to need treatment when you get back, or is it just a case of resting it? And
I've got 2 weeks completely off, and I'm straight to the doctor on Tuesday, just to get a check-up and, yeah, make a bit of a plan. But I think it's definitely healing, because it's definitely less painful. So, you know, it's the tour, no one wants to quit. And obviously having Froome in the jersey and knowing how important it is, just really wanted to be here. And, you know, I always had that hope that come the final week I'd be able to do more of a job, and definitely feel I can do that now. So
can I ask you just quickly about Chris? Because obviously you've known him for a few years now, from the Barlow World years. What were your early impressions of him?
He was a bit like, you know, I don't think he'd really grown up watching bike racing. He'd grown up like riding a bike and enjoying riding and stuff. But, you know, he was a bit oblivious to certain riders and things, you know. And still, even a bit now, he's like, "Who was that?" It's like, "Well, that's Nibbly, mate." You know? But you know, but he just loves that whole sort of training and working hard and climbing. And, you know, he's so professional and dedicated. I think that's the main thing.
I guess you never back then saw him as a future tour winner.
Not a tour winner, no, but definitely a real good climber, and potentially, for sure, because when he rode the tour the first time, I remember seeing him, and he was with Menshov, like, going up some climb, like, towards the end.
I think, wasn't it?
Yeah, I can't remember where, but, like, you could see that he always had that talent, so.
You're listening to the Tour de France podcast with humansinvent.com and Sharp.
It's our penultimate show. I'm with Matt Bowden, Andy Hood, Lionel Burney, and our old friend Chiro, who's tapping away at the end there, as he tends to do during these podcasts. He's a multitasker, but we'll bring him back in at some point.
As usual, because I know that in the press room there are a lot of journalists that think that I'm a tourist, but it's not like that.
You're a what, sorry?
A tourist.
Oh, nobody thinks that, Chiro. Not the amount of time you spend on your phone. We're going to talk about some of the young riders, because I thought there were some very notable performances today. The stage winner, of course, Nairo Quintana, who I think everybody enjoyed his victory. It's well deserved. Moves him up to second overall. Knocked Contador down to fourth overall, so he's not on the podium. Joaquim Rodriguez was the other guy who was up there with Quintana and Froome, so he's now third overall. Great win by him, but there were other great rides today as well. Andrew Talansky of Garmin-Sharp, sixth on the stage. A tremendous performance by him. And our old friend Kwiatkowski, Mikhail Kwiatkowski, the Pole, who's also 23. I think we're looking at GC there, Lionel.
That's GC.
That's three under 25 riders in the top 11. I think that is quite exceptional. Not forgetting Daniel's friend Romain Bardet, who's 15th as well. That's a very. I'd like to know the last time four under 25s finished in the top 15. I'd imagine that's not a very regular occurrence. But any thoughts from you, Matt, on any of those young riders' performances today?
First of all, hats off to Quintana. He's been an attacker this entire Tour de France, and it was great to see him get a stage win. He certainly deserved it. And I guess we can't help but wonder that had he raced a bit more within himself throughout the Tour and had stayed tucked in the wheels.
Well, remember the first day in the Pyrenees, he was sent off on the first climb almost as a decoy for Valverde, which I think was an error.
Yes, absolutely. I mean, if he sits in and follows the wheels, you know, I think he's closer in this Tour. He still loses time in the time trial, but, you know, maybe he sits in and nails Chris on the line a few times. I mean, it's hard to know, but that was a great ride by him, and another great ride, and perhaps I'm being a bit patriotic here, was delivered by Andrew Talansky from Garmin Sharp. We call him the pit bull back in the States because it's not like he's a snarling madman, but he definitely gives it to you straight. And the way he time trialed back up to the Contador group was remarkable today.
Well, I think, Lionel, you spoke to Talansky at the start this morning. Can you introduce your little interview with him?
Yeah, well, I've been very impressed. I think we've all been very impressed with how he's ridden his first Tour. So I wanted to ask him what his thoughts on his debut were.
It's been incredible. It's lived up to every expectation I've had and surpassed most of them. I mean, just from the fans to the racing itself to everything, it's surpassed all the expectations and hopes of the race that I had coming into it.
Have you found it harder than any other race you've done?
Oh, absolutely. There's no other race in the world, no other Grand Tour, no one-day race, nothing that compares to the demands of this race physiologically.
Is that because of the speed and the pressure and the aggression?
From the stress of the first week and people crashing to the actual physiological requirements to be near the front of the race, from as far as power goes, it's just a step above anything else in the world.
You've got really stuck into the racing, which perhaps we shouldn't be surprised about, because I think Jonathan Porter's nicknames you the Pit Bull. Where does that nickname actually come from?
Well, he came up with it. I had no say. But he... I think, you know, he says that, and it really just refers to my determination and, you know, kind of refusal to give up regardless of what's going on.
So what have been the high and low points of the race for you?
Yeah, I'd honestly say the highest point was, you know, there was a day I was in the breakaway and I got third, but the highest point for me was Alptuez. I mean, I felt in control that day, and the fans, and doing Alptuez twice, and that will be the image of the Tour de France this year for me. But that's what I will always remember from this race, is going on Alptuez. And I would say the low moments were kind of the day I cracked in the Pyrenees and Mont Ventoux. That wasn't a great day. That was the day after my breakaway. So those 2 days were the low, but Alptuez was incredible.
As a climber, how do you describe the character of the Pyrenees compared to the Alps, compared to Mont Ventoux? Because probably the first time you've seen them in full-on racing.
I love the Alps. Like, Alpe d'Huez is one of my favorite climbs that I've ever done. We did it in the Dauphiné, and then we did it twice here, and I love it. And it's steady. The roads are nice. It's consistent. The Pyrenees are mean. They're rough and jagged and bad roads and up and down, and it's not suited to my style of climbing at all. So I definitely prefer the Alps.
And in terms of what you've learned from this race, what would you say is the biggest thing you're going to take away from it?
Well, same thing I took away from the Vuelta last year and a lot of the races I've done, is that just never kind of place limitations on yourself. You know, we have these limits that we place because of what we've done in the past. We say, okay, well, I can do this. But this race, I've exceeded those limits time and time again, day and day again. And it's a... kind of always trying to remember that, so that and those days when things don't go right, know that you can have another day that makes up for all of it.
And today, how are you feeling? What do you think you can do on the final climb of the Tour?
The same thing as I did on Alpe d'Huez, which is just, you know, time trial up. I do my, you know, I'm focused on my race. Don't need to, you know, worry about what Froome or Contador or Rodriguez or Quintana are doing. Just do my own race and get to the top as fast as possible.
This is the HumansInvent.com Tour de France podcast. powered by Sharp.
One of the things about Quintana, which was wonderful to see, and Andy, you being the Spanish speaker, you can tell us a little bit about what he actually said, but from his body language, he came into the press room afterwards in floods of tears, sobbing, dabbing his eyes with a hanky. He was very overcome with it all. I mean, do you know Quintana quite well, and was that quite typical from him?
It was actually very surprising to see that emotional kind of release, because even the way he races, he has this kind of mask of you know, he looks like what he actually is, which is a Colombian, you know, campesino. He comes from a very poor, modest background. And he was recounting his journey from Colombia. I mean, he lives high in elevation, I think 2,700 meters. You know, it's a typical story where his mother saved the money to buy the bike. He rode like 16 kilometers downhill to the school, 16 back up. And for him, kind of recounting that moment and recounting, the question was, you know, you achieved all these great things today. Did you ever dream of doing that? He goes, yeah, I dreamed it, but I never imagined it would come so soon, so quickly. That's when he kind of touched him. He started to tear up. And you know that they're just going crazy back at Colombia. It's the best ever finish in the tour by South America.
Wow, yeah, that's a good point. That kind of passed me by.
You mentioned the previous wave of Colombian riders in the early 80s was coincided with when I first got into cycling, and Luis Herrera and Fabio Parra were two riders who really excited me just because of the way they rode. I mean, Herrera was like, his nickname was the Little Bird. He was a tiny little guy. He looked like he'd sort of stolen his older brother's bike. The King of the Mountains jersey kind of hung off him, particularly, you know, when you know, they didn't have jerseys made to fit such a tiny frame. Fabio Parra.
He was like an old man, like Quintana.
Fabio Parra was more, he always wore the casquette, yeah, the cloth cap, and whenever you saw him without the hat or a helmet on, he looked kind of like when Darth Vader is unmasked in Return of the Jedi, you know, the kind of slightly unusually striking looking. Quintana, to me, he kind of looks physically a bit like the boxer Oscar De La Hoya, and he's got a similar sort of face and a similar kind of stockyish build, and he can deliver a knockout punch a bit like De La Hoya as well. I mean, fantastic to watch him ride, and he kind of measured it today. He didn't just get carried away with the possibility of winning the stage and getting second and the King of the Mountains jersey, but he was actually quite clinical about it when it mattered.
I think he's wonderful. He's so stylish. He's even had, you know, never mind finishing second on the tour, winning Best Young Rider, winning King of the Mountains, winning a stage day, never mind all that. He's been up for our Pedlar de Charme Award on one or two occasions, and a worthy nominee he is too. He's really great to watch, and it's effortless. It looks effortless with him.
Andy, you guess his bike size? I confirmed this yesterday.
48 centimetres or something.
46.
46, wow. One theory that we've mentioned or discussed, Lionel, totally unscientific, but is one of the reasons that the Colombians disappeared, that the EPO era of the 90s and early 2000s just negated the natural advantages they have, growing up in altitude, having the great climbing ability that they had. Was that a factor, do you think, in their disappearance for a few years?
It certainly could have been completely unscientific, and it's just a... Just from looking at the trend, in the 80s there were Colombian riders. It wasn't just Herrera and Parra. They actually had two teams of riders in the tour. And they struggled in the crosswinds and they struggled on the flat and they lost a lot of time. But they always attacked in the mountains. In the 90s, really, there was Alvaro Mejia and Chepi
with
Gonzalez.
With the arm warmers, always wore arm warmers.
That's right, and Chepi Gonzalez, who won a couple of stages, and Botero, of course. But Botero wasn't a
not
of bird,
typical. No.
Wasn't a bird-like climber. He was more of a rouleur.
Quite a different background, I think, didn't he? More middle class.
That's right. Yeah. But to see these kind of the new wave of Colombian riders coming back, Betancourt in the Giro. Uran and Henao at Sky, and Quintana. I mean, I was thinking today, what a team for the World Championships they will have.
Absolutely, especially this year, hilly course. I'm going to just introduce now another journalist. As you can imagine, at this stage of the tour, there's a press room here full of people just desperate to get onto our podcast. And earlier today, I spoke to another of our colleagues, Rupert Guinness, another doyen, who is on the judging panel this year for the Prix de Citron and Prix d'Orange, which decides both the most unpopular and the most popular, or the most impolite and the most polite riders in the race this year. So here's what Rupert had to tell me about that competition.
So I'm here with Rupert Guinness, a doyen of the press room, Australian veteran journalist. Sorry, Rupert, but you are. 87 was your first tour?
87, that's right, Richard.
Yeah. Yeah. Everyone since then, or?
No, that's 27 tours, so this is my 25th.
Wow.
My good math makes that 25. Yeah, two I've missed. Yeah.
So did you get an award this year? Because you normally get a medal for 25, do you know?
Oh, it's for 20. Yeah, so I got that little medal. You finish as medal, it's like that. I got that 2008.
And am I not right in thinking they spelt your name incorrectly?
They certainly did. They spelled it Ruppert.
Two P's.
And
Robert.
And now at work at the City Morning Herald, they call me Rupert.
Excellent. So, Rupert, you've got the great honour this year of being a judge for the Prix Citroën and the Prix Orange. Can you just explain what those two awards are?
Well, the two awards, the Prix Citroën is an award that's meant to be handed from the representative to the from the media to the rider who has been not really into the mood of the festivity and the joy of the event.
The most unpleasant is what you're trying to say, aren't you?
Almost difficult.
The rudest.
Yes, it can be interpreted in many ways. It is awarded, you know, with a bit of tongue-in-cheek, and it's an opportunity for the recipient to be able to take a step back and go and laugh at himself as well.
Or take a good hard look at himself.
That's right, it's up to...
And examine his conduct.
It's a many and varied response that a rider can take with it.
I don't want to... You're one of a panel of journalists. I don't want to compromise your integrity by asking you to reveal who you'll be voting for, but I've got a suspicion that Mark Cavendish might be a front runner this year, having grabbed a reporter's dictaphone.
Well, I mean, that's certainly a potentially title-winning feat. You know, but the Tour de France is about 21 stages. You know, you can't win the Tour on one stage, and I think, you know, I've got to think long tonight about, you know, the performances of other contenders. I mean, a lot of things happen, as you know, Richard, out there on the...
On the road,
and you know, it's very easy just to jump to conclusions and think that one or two incidents or achievements may.
Your man Cadel Evans must traditionally be a front runner, although he's been pretty good this year, I think.
Yeah, he has been pretty. Yeah, he's been very good actually. I mean, actually, very good, but not very good. But he probably should be good on the bike. But he, there was years he would have been a strong contender.
2008, I recall, you pestered him for an interview. Sorry, requested an interview. And he handed you his... He'd crashed that day. I remember he handed you his helmet, didn't he? His broken helmet.
Yeah, that's right. He crashed and there was a media scrum outside his van, and we all thought we'd been flicked. We weren't going to get the interview. The door shut, and we all of a sudden turned our backs, and then the door opened. And suddenly I turned around and there was this hand. It wasn't quite the hand of God, but it was a hand. It came through out this this helmet with the words, "There's your interview," and the door shut. Next thing, it's in my hands. And I'm thinking, what the hell is it? I realise it's Cadel's helmet that's fractured. And within seconds, there was a media scrum around me and someone saying, "What are you looking at, Rupert?" And I'm thinking, well, of course.
Rupert,
sorry. And next thing, I'm giving this expert analysis of the fractured structure of the helmet.
A media personality.
I was a helmet expert for 15 seconds.
And the Prix Orange, that's for the politest.
Yeah. It's sort of the
nicest.
Good bloke award.
The good bloke award.
The good bloke award, you know.
Any front runners for that?
Now I've given myself, by calling it the good bloke award, it sounds like I'll just give it to an Aussie. A green edge rider.
Obviously.
Actually, should give it to the green edge driver, Gary.
Yeah.
You know, the bus gazer.
But
I think, that's a hard one too, because the one thing about these two awards, you've actually got to think not about what your perception, you've got to ask your colleagues. And my brief has been to think about they said the étrangers, and then they said, well, the non-French anyway.
Yeah.
So can't just think of the people I've mixed with. I've got to talk to people like yourself for some input.
Happy to offer it. But any contenders for the Prix Orange, do you think?
Well, look, I think, you know, Chris Froome has got to be a contender. You know, I mean, he's given so much time. Well, he has to give the time he does for press conferences, and I think that's one of the issues. We would like to have more time, but when you think of the time that a yellow jersey takes for him to get to the hotel, quite often it's at 10 o'clock at night. And I know Chris Froome's had to eat by himself most nights, or a lot of nights. But the way he's handled the doping questions, whatever side of the argument you take, or the side of suspicion, he has not cracked once as far as his demeanour. He's kept calm, he's responded to questions, and he did use the C word once. He said, "That's not cool." Not quite the C word we heard a year ago.
Wiggins, a year ago.
But the C word was used.
Brilliant. Yes, yeah, so that really sums up the difference between those two, perhaps. Now, I think the Prix Citron was abandoned for a few years. I think Lance Armstrong was possibly the last recipient, and he was, I think you were counting this earlier, he was handed a bowl of lemons.
Yeah, I remember the photographers actually handed him the award. He came up to the podium to sign on again, and they did it. And you know how these guys, they're on the podium, they're given all these different awards. They just think it's part of the protocol, and they take the award, smile for the photo, give the award to one of their minions to take away. Next thing, here's another one, and there was one of the French photographers came up with his basket of lemons, and Lance almost took it, and he said, "What's this for?" And he was explained, "This is the Prix Citron for the most difficult rider to deal with." He didn't see the humour of it, put it that way. He didn't put his hands on the award either. I think he turned and there was a little bit of an elbow given. I think he hooked the photographer with the lemons.
Excellent. That's great. Well, good luck with your deliberating, Rupert, and we look forward to hearing the results of your inquiries, and we'll hear that tomorrow. We'll be in Paris.
Yeah, it'll be in Monday's L'Equipe, and so there's always pressure all the way to the end of this race. It's never over till you get to Paris.
This is a humansinvent.com Tour de France podcast with Richard Moore and Lionel Burney.
Okay, here we are as the sun sets on Semnoz. That sounds good. Last part of our little podcast where we've got a lot to run through. We're going to go through some of our highlights and lowlights and obviously do our Pedalar de Charme with Ciro here to help us with that. Ciro, are you still bogged down in work there? How are you getting on with that latest story? Is that Vincenzo Nibali's column that you're writing there?
Not tomorrow.
Okay. Tomorrow. When's he going to appear in the paper again?
Actually, I don't know. Maybe never. As a, as a journalist, I want to say, I hope not as a writer, but maybe... Not in this weekend, I think.
Has he been writing a column about the tour while it's been going on?
Only three times.
And what's he had to say? Has he enjoyed it?
Yeah.
Could he have won?
In my opinion, I don't think that he would have been at the same level of Chris Froome. A little bit less, especially in the time trial. I mean, difficult to compare, but I think this Froome has, in my opinion, stronger than Nibali in the Giro. Certainly, it's also true that the only guy who was capable to beat Chris Froome this year is still Nibali at Tirreno Adriatico, the only defeat of Froome.
Okay, let's go through some highlights and lowlights. I'll kick this off. I've picked out a couple of highlights, a couple of lowlights. I wrote this morning, so it's kind of out of date, but my lowlights were polka dot shorts, which thankfully Pierre Roland abandoned today, and moustaches. In the peloton.
Jérôme Cousin has got quite a fine moustache, I think.
There's no such thing as a fine moustache. I know, that's an oxymoron.
Okay.
Are there no circumstances a moustache acceptable?
Zero? Not in the peloton. Not in a professional. Why shave your legs and you know, grow a caterpillar under your nose? What's the point of that? Anyway, I also was going to talk about Belkin. I've been impressed with Belkin at this tour, just sort of left field there. So many others, Quintana is an obvious one. Movistar as a team have ridden very well, contributed an awful lot to the race. Matt, any highlights, lowlights you want to alight upon?
Oh, jeez. I don't know where to start. But first off, I'd be a fool if I didn't highlight Andrew Hood as a mentor and
a
buddy. And he comes up with all these things called the hoodie rules. We're working out a column about the hoodie rules and how to cover the Tour de France with all these, because you just die.
Is this your second
them.
Tour?
It's just my second
so
tour.
So have you learned, so covering the tour, doing two with Andy is probably like doing 10 on your own.
Or just, yes. No, wait, I've misspoke. He does snore a bit though. I had to kick him last night.
Yeah. Give us a couple of the hoodie rules.
Well, I can't give away all of them because I believe that hoodie could probably write a book on it.
Publishing deal is imminent.
Yeah, the best one is eat where you sleep. So you must get to your hotel before you do anything.
Is that anything to do with the alcohol consumption?
No, I think it just has to do with driving at night and being safe.
Yeah,
generally.
Sure.
But it may. As far as my actual highlight performances, I'm going to have to say Chris Froome's attack on Mont Ventoux. That's something that probably I will never forget, no matter what sport I cover after this, or you know, whatever happens. I mean, in my life, I'll remember the stunning velocity at which he attacked Quintana and then came through that corner, and it was I don't know what to say, it was ridiculous. It was a leg blender. And another highlight I had was is honestly, it's kind of old to say it, but I don't think you can say it enough, Richie Porte. He's been immense. He's huge at this Tour de France. The way he's gotten dropped off of groups and then come back up and then towed Chris back. And, you know, Sue, we could say what we will about this year's Tour compared to last year's Tour, but you got the feeling on Sky, at least publicly, and what we saw on the road for the most part, was a very in-step team with the goal of getting Chris Froome to Paris in yellow. And, you know, it seemed to be a little bit different last year with the tension between...
Interesting. The team appeared stronger last year, and I think they've developed a kind of siege mentality. I saw a tweet from Geraint Thomas earlier, which kind of said, you know, so much for a rubbish team, that here's to the haters. So I don't know if they've been getting a lot of criticism. We've been quite critical of them, I suppose. But they haven't looked like as strong a team as last year, but certainly a more united team, I think.
Yes.
Andy, any highlights, lowlights for you?
I thought today was perhaps not a highlight, but just an affirmation of the Yenzi. I mean, this last Tour de France, who do we see off the front like a madman but our favorite German, Jens Voigt. I mean, I was down at the Tour Down Under this year, and I remember him at, there's the crit there before the Tour Down Under starts, and he was joking to everyone, first race, first attack. And here he is today. He's last Tour.
Is it last attack. Year? Is it his last year as well?
Pretty much. I mean, Even today he was saying he's not sure, but even later he said, yeah, it's probably my last Tour. I wanted to say goodbye to the Tour in my own way. And he's one of those characters that it seems like today's modern peloton, there's less and fewer of those kinds of strong personalities that aren't afraid to speak their minds and bring that kind of charisma to the sport. I think the sport's missing that almost in a lot of ways.
I'd have to say a couple of highlights just from today, from standing out and seeing it on the road and watching not just the leaders come through, but everybody else. I stayed out there for half an hour until the last man on the road came past. But one of the guys from the Belkin team, Bram Tankink, came past, and he was on his own, sort of in no man's land, didn't have anyone to ride with, but he looked like he was loving it, and the crowd responded to him, and he was kind of like getting the crowd to cheer by waving his arm and cupping his ear. And when you see little moments like that, you just remember just how long those fans have been out on the mountain today. You know, they've waited all day, probably not with much shelter from the sun. And it's not just about the guys at the front, it's also about the people who are sort of 5, 10, 15 minutes down. And then I waited for the last man on the road, who was Navadauskas of the Garmin Sharp team. A big, strong rider on the flat, maybe normally a bit better than this in the hills, so perhaps he's got a problem, I'm not too sure. But he must have been right on the limit for the time cut, because he was getting encouragement shouted out of the Garmin Sharp team car. I think it was by Lionel Marie, their number two DS. I think it was him, I couldn't quite see. But just to see him being cheered on and encouraged to get inside the time cut, which they say could have been very close. Just nice to see those little moments every now and again.
Lovely atmosphere. You know, as we're driving up Alpe d'Huez a couple of days ago, we were just commenting on the sheer number of people there, and the goodwill and the probable lack of arrests and trouble and all the rest of it. You know, for a major sporting event, that's one of the real real great things about the Tour, I think. Ciro, any highlights and lowlights for you from the Tour?
I was not really well impressed for Philippe Gilbert, the world champion. I mean, no victory, no victories in this year. Certainly, he tried some breakaways, but I mean, certainly a season really not good for him. We know that he had a new contract with BMC till 2016, but I'm not sure that everything is the team is working well. I know also that there are some problems between him and John Elang, so let's see. As highlight, maybe also Peter Sagan is an highlight of this Tour. Less victories than 2012, so one, certainly he has also the possibility tomorrow, but for the moment one instead of three, but second time in a row the green jersey, and there is also someone that is asking if he could reach the record of Eric Zabel, six in a row.
Thank you, Ciro. And we're going to hear from Ciro again now.
And now, pedaler de charme.
Thank you for that, Chiro. Finally, guys, can we go around? You can nominate a pedaler de charme and a pedaler sans charme if you want, one or other or both. Any candidates today for pedaler de charme? I think your nomination just now, Lionel, perhaps. Or...
Well, Bram Tankink, yeah, he deserves a nomination. Also, Sylvain Chavanel, who was in the village this morning, and he took an awful lot of time with fans. He posed for probably 6 or 7 photographs in a row, signed autographs, and did it, even though the bell had gone and a lot of the riders were heading to the start. And you know that when people get into that village, to meet one of the riders and to spend a little bit of time with them, and to have a rider like Chavanel, obviously a big hero in France, spend that much time with people was great to see as well.
Mm-hmm. I've nominated him for Pedaler de Charme. I'll nominate him today for Pedaler sans Charme. Alberto Contador slipped off the podium. Just not the Contador of old. The way he struggled up that climb, lost quite a lot of time today. Something's not right with Contador. He is not maybe Andy Hood can shed a bit of light on that, being a Spanish expert. But Matt, any nominations?
I'm going to have to go with Nicky Terpstra, and it's just for general reasons, because I like him as a rider, and I like to interview him. You ask him a question, and he has this look that comes across his face, and it's like he's pondering it for a moment, and he always smiles before he answers your question. And so to me, I just like to go over and talk to Nicky Terpstra. I think he's a real classy rider, and he's always got time for everybody, and he's always got time for you know, the other team's DSs want to chat with him and reporters and all that. And so for me, it's Nicky Terpstra.
What a job he did to help Mark Cavendish win his second stage.
Absolutely.
In this tour. Andy, any nominations?
I would go for rider Sancharm. I think Matt would be in agreement with me, just with TJ Van Garderen. He's one of those kind of riders who, when things are going well, you know, he's great to chat to. When things aren't going so well, he doesn't want to talk to anybody. And, you know, as journalists, we have to understand that. We have to understand, give these guys space. They're humans. But a lot of times we'll look on and envy at our Italian and Spanish colleagues when those guys come across the line. Doesn't matter if they've won or lost. They take that 2-3 minutes and speak to us. We have to tell our story. Whereas a lot of times with certain riders, as we all know, have their prickly ways. And sometimes, and TJ's had a rough ride during this tour, of course. I mean, he's been up and down. He came in with the big GC ambitions. You know, fell short the other day on the Alpe d'Huez, almost won that stage. But, you know, I'd have to give him the old San Charm.
Do you think Contador can come back and win the tour again? He was tweeting tonight that he, you know, was very motivated already for 2014. The preparation for 2014 starts now, he said. Do you think we can see the old Contador again?
Yeah, that's one thing that I was trying to nose around the Saxo Bank bus this morning. I talked to Reese a little bit about that. Because when you look at kind of Reese and Contador, they're kind of the old school style of riders, for better or worse of that connotation of what that means. And against, the Skyways, I mean, I think those guys are going to have a hell of a time trying to catch up to what Sky's doing. I think that the stories you hear from Reese, just in the way he runs the team, that you hear the stories about Reese. He doesn't let, you know, they'll bring in experts on fitting and time trial positioning and tech, and Reese will say, no, the seat post goes there. Mm. And he's the kind of guy who doesn't like to listen to outside advice, whereas you look at a team like Sky, they have this whole wealth of advisors and experts. They all kind of just bring this collective mentality to it. And I think Contador, he's 30, just turned 30 this year. I think we've seen the best of Contador. I mean, you can't say he might not win another tour, but looking at Froome and what he's capable of, I don't think we'll ever see Contador win the tour again, in my personal opinion.
Great. Well, thank you very much, guys, for that. I just remember we were going to ask you briefly about your experience last night at Team Sky, but will we have to read that about that on Velo News? Is that what we should do?
Oh heavens. That may be one of those things you don't read for quite some time. I believe that they have gone through the same process.
Yeah, can you say in 2 minutes, you know, how you found you had a briefing, basically, with Tim Karras and Dave Brailsford.
Yeah, we talked, Andy and I and another journalist from Boulder, Joe Lindsay, and NBC correspondent Steve, also sat in on that. And it was basically just sort of a rundown of the Sky process and sort of how they seek outside counsel, how they go about their power curve analysis, and, you know, where they try to... it's just essentially that marginal gains sort of approach, but it was when it's explained to you like that, when you talk to the guys about it, I mean, it makes a little bit more sense. And, you know, certainly we still have to keep our wits about us and treat every team the same. But to see the numbers and to see why Sky, you know, are so good at this tour, at last tour, and look to be at tours in the future. I mean, it's helpful. It's helpful to see sort of the process that they go through.
Great. Thank you very much, Matt, and thanks very much for coming back on.
Yeah, absolutely.
Thank you, Lionel.
Thank you, Richard.
Thank you, Andy.
Well, thanks for finally inviting me on the penultimate stage. I appreciate that.
Next year you'll be a more regular guest. I think you've impressed tonight. You know, yeah. Chira's waving. That doesn't really come across in the podcast, Chira. You might have to actually say goodbye.
Goodbye to all our listeners. Let's hope to have this postcard again, but before the next Tour de France.
Let's try and do that.
We need it.
We need it.
And also you listeners need it.